Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled Representing Central Americans and UACs in Hostile Jurisdictions. I'm JJ Area, AILA's Education Associate, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Bradley Jenkins from Washington, D.C. Joining Bradley is Carolina Antonini from Atlanta, Georgia, and Andres Lopez from Charlotte, North Carolina. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Bradley.
Thanks. Hi, everybody. What we want to do today is describe what the experience of lawyers is in hostile jurisdictions, meaning jurisdictions that in which judges may show hostility or aggressiveness with regard to certain kinds of particularly asylum claims, to share our experiences in those jurisdictions, to share our ethical obligations to our clients and the judges' ethical rules, and finally to brainstorm with our panel today to come up with solutions and share what has worked for us. So what I would like to do is for everybody on the panel to introduce themselves, but also to share an experience about what we're meaning by judicial hostility to a claim. And so why don't we start with Carolina?
Yes, happy to be with you. I have been practicing in one of the most hostile jurisdictions for over 20 years, and I have been surviving. So I am happy to share with you my experiences. In Atlanta, we have consistently the lowest asylum grant in the nation. We have judges that are very hostile to asylum seekers in particular, and they will do things like being offensive, going off record to make comments, taking judicial notices of things that are inappropriate. For example, I represented a Somalian lady who had been held captive in a military a camp for a year and a half and had been repeatedly raped. And the judge went off the record and said to me that he did not believe my client because she had been raped so many times but never had gotten pregnant. When we went back on the record, I, of course, went over what the judge had said off the record and had objected to his taking judicial notice of things that he was not competent to take judicial notices, such as the medical ability of a woman to get pregnant under such circumstances. And as you might imagine, from there on, the hearing was extraordinarily hostile. These are the sort of things that we have been dealing with in Atlanta for over 20 years that I've been practicing here.
Thanks for sharing that, Carolina. Andres? Oh, do we still have Andres?
Sorry, I was on
there. There we go.
There we go. Yes, this is Andres. I'm happy to be here. Glad to be here. Practice in the Charlotte Immigration Court, which is getting to be more known as a hostile jurisdiction. There have been incidents where attorneys are threatened with complaints for filing frivolous asylum claims, even though they are, they have merit, and we have a right to file asylum claims and go all the way to the individual hearing. We have incidents where attorneys are taken into the quarters, into the chambers, and told, basically told what's wrong with their case, and prejudicial comments are made in court regarding these type of claims, whether all these claims coming from Central America, especially domestic violence claims or gang-based claims. What's particularly more concerning are respondents who are pro se. And it's been noted more recently, especially that when attorneys are not around, once the attorneys have gone through, pro se respondents are being basically intimidated or coerced into taking orders removal or voluntary departure. So they may express some fear, or they've had a credible fear determination interview that says they have credible fear, but the judges will just outright say, you have no claim here. I wouldn't grant it. And so the only thing you really have is an order of deportation, to take an order of removal or voluntary departure order. So this is what makes this jurisdiction in Charlotte particularly hostile, is sort of a very conservative, strict view of trying to get people in and out the door as quickly as possible.
And to share, this is Bradley Jenkins, to share our experience here, certainly I wouldn't describe my local immigration courts as hostile, but my role is the director of the Board of Immigration Appeals Pro Bono Project. And so what we do here at the Catholic Legal Immigration Network is to find pro bono attorneys to represent people who were pro se below and pro se before the board during their appeals to the BIA. And our project here is national in scope, so we get to see the practices regarding pro se litigants throughout the country. And we have seen similarly problematic behavior from some immigration judges from and the patterns that we've been able to notice here are again, we have also seen attempts to prejudge claims, expressing at master calendar hearings that to a pro se litigant that this claim will not work, even when it's squarely within cases like ARCG for a domestic violence type claim. We've also seen the problematic practice of judges going off the record to say things that they know would create appellate issues if they were said on the record. And we've also seen troubling credibility practices in which immigration judges try to use, for example, omissions from credible fear notes, which are, of course, notes that don't purport to be complete, and interviews that don't purport to capture the entire claim, but relying on those sorts of notes and the respondent's purported failure to disclose some important part of their case in that interview. We've seen immigration judges try to attempt to make adverse credibility findings. So this is sort of the overview of what we mean is about attempting to practice in a hostile jurisdiction. But before we get on to pure tactics regarding how to address this in our cases and how to, notwithstanding hostility to a claim in front of a trial court, how to win asylum cases for people in these jurisdictions, one thing that we wanted to cover was ethics, both judicial ethics and our professional ethics as attorneys. And Andres had had the scariest thing that a lawyer can hear, right? Because our licenses are on the line, is when a judge threatens to file a complaint to our bar because the claim we are filing is frivolous, right? That it's
yeah.
always scary when a judge uses the F word, F for frivolous. And so
yes.
we thought it was...
I think in my case, I had a judge who basically had filed a 42B. Based on what the client had told me. And then the judge basically asked my client at the master, well, when did you leave and when did you come back, to see if he was within 90 days of that departure, which would disqualify you or not. And then my client basically told the court something different than what he had told me,
mm-hmm.
right, that he had actually departed and came back to the United States more than 90 days, which would have disqualified him for the 42B cancellation removal. And so the judge then looked at me and said, you know, you have filed something that for which he is clearly not eligible. I am going to file a complaint against you. And that type of behavior by the judges is particularly very chilling and intimidating. It was never filed, you know, because I told the judge, like, this is what he told me. I have my notes. I learned a lesson there that it's a bit scary in court when the judge takes it upon themselves to basically, try to tell attorneys, that they're doing something wrong. Not only, that their client is not eligible, but that they're doing something unethical.
I think the sole purpose for judges, for the most part, particularly in hostile jurisdiction, for soliciting testimony that should be solicited in an individual hearing and doing so in a master calendar, is to try to catch the lawyer or catch the person or pre-term it or have somebody who's unprepared testify. And that's particularly troubling because immigration judges have 16 canons of ethical behavior. These are published freely in their website, and they have only 16 canons in commentary. Obviously, immigration judges have to observe the canons of ethics that go along with whatever state has barred them. But in particularly for judges who are in a hostile jurisdiction, I would encourage people to look at these canons and to particularly look at Canon 9 and Canon 10 and then read the commentary, because these are canons that are constantly violated by immigration judges when it comes to dealing with asylees. It says that an immigration judge shall be patient, dignified, courteous to litigants, witnesses, to lawyers, and others, and shall not, in the performance of official duties, by words or conduct, manifest bias or prejudice. That's Canon 9. Canon 10 says that they have to act in a professional manner. And then the commentary at the bottom basically says that a judge who manifests bias or engages in unprofessional conduct during a hearing that may even show that the fairness of the proceeding would be in question has violated their ethical canons. So, and it tells judges that they have to be alert and avoid such behavior, the inappropriate demeanor, anything that could be perceived as prejudicial. And so, obviously, you want to read these canons. I can tell you that when you point these canons out to a judge, you can be prepared to receive some hostility at the end of your pointing this out. But judges do have to reminded sometimes that they have to adhere by these canons that have been published for their guidance and that they violate, constantly.
Right. Bradley and Carolina, I'm not sure if you had seen the statistic as to the percent of immigration court cases that were granted in Atlanta and Charlotte.
Yes.
But in Atlanta, it's 1.8% of cases where relief was granted. In Charlotte, it's 2.6% where relief was granted. And by the way, Stewart Detention Center, which is in Georgia, not far from Atlanta, is 1.1%. For asylum cases where asylum was granted, in Atlanta, it's 2.1%, and Charlotte's 12.6%. But I would say that's particularly because just one of the three judges is not as hostile to asylum claims, especially for Central Americans. So I just wanted to put that out there, because the statistics just kind of, they kind of smack you in the face.
The Atlanta numbers have been consistently at the very bottom in all the years that I've been practicing. And I have spoken to judges about these numbers. And every single judge always has a reason for the numbers. And the reason is that the cases that they get are not that great, the attorneys do a poor job, and so forth. And I always tell them, if we accommodate for any kind of margin of error on the side of the immigration attorney, on the fact that you may not get better claims, et cetera, still taking all of that into consideration, the numbers really speak of a profound problem.
Correct.
So what is the solution to these problems? I want to sort of move the conversation towards a place where we're talking about strategies for addressing these sorts of things. And one thing that I'll sort of open up and talk about is one counter to an aggressive judge is knowing our own ethics rules as attorneys, when especially if a judge is throwing around this word of frivolous. I'm looking right now at the ABA's comments for the model rule of professional conduct 3.1. Most jurisdictions have an identical rule and identical, if not nearly identical, comments. And this is something I sometimes read when I'm making an argument that I know is going may receive less than hospitable reception by the adjudicator. But it's always good to remind us that, and this is the second comment to the ABA's model rule 3.1, is the filing of an action or defense is not frivolous merely because the facts have not been fully substantiated or because the lawyer expects to develop vital evidence only by discovery. What is required of lawyers, however, is that they inform themselves about the facts of their client's case and the applicable law and determine that they can make good faith arguments in support of their client's positions. Such action is not frivolous, even though the lawyer believes that the client's position ultimately will not prevail. Those two ideas, that as long as you can make a good faith argument under current law or make a good faith argument to extend, reverse, or modify existing law under the facts as you've come to know them, and the idea that even if you think you're going to lose, that doesn't mean the claim is frivolous. You can bring a hard case, and sometimes we have to sort of give ourselves a pep talk before going into court to say, I can bring this hard case. I think I may lose it, but as long as my client knows that it's a hard case and wants to bring it anyway, and the arguments I am bringing are made in good faith, then we have to have the sort of armor to not let other people in that courtroom throw around the idea that our claim is frivolous, and we have to politely and steadfastly continue bringing the claim. So that's the first sort of opening idea. Yeah, Carolina.
Another thing is, you know, there is safety in numbers, and one of the problems that we have in hostile jurisdictions is that representing asylum claims has been such a downer. I mean, as you know, with most asylum claims, they're not exactly the most profitable claims. They're emotionally engaging. They're very serious, life-defining type of cases. And many people choose not to take asylum defensively, because they don't want to bother going to the immigration court. And the truth is that most of the litigants of asylum in Atlanta, in our jurisdiction, are pro se, as they are at Stewart, which is terrible because there is certainly at least a 30% chance that that an attorney would better somebody's chance if an attorney was engaged. So as long as judges get pro se litigants in our jurisdictions, they're going to be able to continue what they're doing because there's no one to advocate for these people. So I hope that we encourage people to take asylum claims, to arm themselves with the courage to do this, because the more of us that there are out there making these claims, the better we will do, the stronger we will be. So, you know, there will be somewhat of that strength in numbers. And there are plenty of practitioners out there, including myself, who serve as mentors, so that if you are thinking about taking an asylum claim and you're afraid to do it, there is always a mentor that you can engage that can help you either strategize, present, or even face the hostile judge and teach you how to overcome that.
Great. Thank you, Carolina. Andres, do you have some...
Yeah, I think what's important is just, you know, when you're representing a client, you're supposed to zealously advocate for them, right? And I think sometimes I've talked about this with other colleagues here who go to Charlotte Immigration Court is that a lot of attorneys have been intimidated, right, into doing things, particularly because we want to keep our reputation, or we don't want to lose our reputation, because the judges have made comments as to the effect as like, well, you're filing something and I'm going to lose respect for you, or something to that effect, right? And it's this sort of atmosphere of intimidation, or, you know, it's hard to explain, but it's, why would I want to represent someone who has a weak asylum claim if that's going to hurt my reputation and hurt my other clients? So what that does is it makes me less likely to take other cases or weaker asylum cases, so then I can make sure that I have the credibility to represent other clients who have stronger asylum cases. But the problem with that is that, you know, everybody else who has a weaker asylum case will not be represented, as Catalina was saying, that they end up being representing themselves pro se. So the more attorneys we have that are basically challenging the system, and it's important to note that asylum claims, you can't be pretermitted. It has to go all the way to the individual hearing to be heard. I guess that's what I'm trying to say, is just go through the process and zealously advocate for the client, because that's what you have in front of you. And if there's any problem with the judge, make sure you keep it on the record, or summarize anything that's been off the record. Make sure that you have things on appeal to object to, and make sure you hold the judge accountable for their actions.
Right. So this brings me to one thing that I want to discuss with both of you, which is one obvious frontline strategy for litigating asylum claims in a court with a 1 or 2% grant weight is to prepare your claim for an appeal, right? So I want to solicit from the other members of our panel sort of their best practices about preparing a case for trial, but where the audience is really the Board of Immigration Appeals. But first, I did want to note for everybody who's listening, two really important cases that everybody should read where they are concerned about judicial hostility or a judge prejudging a claim. The first case is the board's recent decision in matter of YSLC, and that case has the unfortunate distinction of having as a headnote that immigration judges should not engage in conduct with juveniles, which can be interpreted as hostile or bullying. Essentially, in matter of YSLC, the immigration judge, when an attorney had asked what psychological impact the persecution had on them, the immigration judge took over the examination of the witness and started asking questions as if they were qualifying a 12-year-old, I believe, or a minor in any event, as an expert in psychology, asking how often he had lectured on psychology at the university level and other just patently ridiculous questions. And the board reversed, and of course, based on due process grounds. But one of the important holdings of YSLC, beyond a showing that the board is willing to correct some of the more egregious errors of immigration judges, is that this is the first published opinion of which I'm aware in which the board, in a published opinion, ordered remand to a different immigration judge. And this is one strategic move that folks can make on appeal, that if the immigration judge has a colorable claim of bias or hostility or a more egregious deprivation of due process, that one form of relief that you can ask for from the board is to not only remand the case to the immigration judge, but to remand it to a different immigration judge. that may or may not provide more or less complete relief in your case, but Matter of YSLC is your precedential hook for that sort of argument. The second case I wanted to bring up, and this is especially important if the immigration judge makes prejudicial remarks before an individual hearing, and I'm using prejudicial in the most literal sense here, in the sense that the immigration judge has prejudged the case before hearing the evidence, is a matter of EFHL, which was decided, I believe, in 2015, maybe 2014. But the holding of EFHL is that the immigration judge does have a duty to develop the record, and part of that duty is that applicants for asylum have an absolute right to an individual hearing, that an immigration judge may not just look at the affidavits and evidence and the lawyer's offer of proof about the theory of the case and pretermit an asylum application on that basis, that the actual receiving of evidence is guaranteed by the statute and regulations, and so an individual hearing must be had. And the language of EFHL would also be helpful in any appeal based on prejudging the case before hearing the evidence, right? So EFHL and YSLC could even be used in tandem about prejudging a claim and any showing of bias or hostility. So I also now want to sort of turn it over. There's after that sort of discussion of some of the pertinent case law to trial strategy to Carolina and Andres.
Right. That's exactly right. You know, every client have a right to an individual hearing for asylum cases. The problem here in Charlotte, I'm sure it may be the same in Atlanta, is that immigration judges are starting to insulate themselves. Basically, they write their decisions in such a way as that they hide their prejudice, right? And the way they hide their prejudice or their hostility towards these claims is they look at the credible fear determinations, they look at the CBP statements, they look at the declarations submitted, and then they look at the testimony, and they see if there are discrepancies. And usually there always are, especially because CBP statements tend to be boilerplate language. I've seen toddlers being asked questions, why did you come to the United States? And the toddler responding, I came to work in the United States. So we have to challenge those CBP statements as whether they're really actually valid for purposes of asylum hearings. When the CFA comes, if you have the CFI statement, you have to make sure and explore whether it's accurate. And if it's not accurate, you want your declaration, your testimony to address it, because if you don't address it, the judge will address it in a negative way and infer that negative adverse credibility to that discrepancy. So that's one way that they can be sneaky, and just basically writing it in such a way where they're hostile to the claims, they're prejudicial to these claims, but they write it in such a way as that they hide their denial within their discretion to determine the facts, and that makes it extremely difficult to win on appeal. Carolina?
Yes, Atlanta also uses credibility as a very wide mallet for all these cases. And so you have to make sure to explain discrepancies on the record. You need to make sure to address those affirmatively and provide the reasonable explanations. I have also asked the judge to subpoena the officer who wrote the credible fear or the assessment, the CBP officer. They've never shown up to court, but the judge is then far more circumspect about my objection because the government has not provided the source of the information. You really want to look and compare all of the statements and want to make sure that in testimony that your client not only goes through everything in detail, but that also explains why their maybe written statement in the application for asylum is not as complete. The immigration judges in Atlanta love to fault people for having things in testimony that were not written in the application. Even the smallest insignificant things, they will use that for purposes of filing a lack of credibility. And they use credibility because they know that that's where they have the widest leeway from the BIA. But, yeah, it is a huge problem. Make sure that you are filling in those gaps and explain discrepancies and then aggressively fighting whatever government statements and maybe even asking to subpoena those officers to cross-examine them.
I think the other challenge, especially in hostile jurisdictions, is our clients. You know, our clients sometimes are their worst enemies simply because they don't have the education. They're not articulate enough. They've been traumatized to a point where their memory is hazy with respect to dates, with respect to the reasons why they're being persecuted, especially women who have been abused by domestic partners. And it's difficult to prepare them, but you should try and do your best to prepare them and for the hostility that they'll receive at the individual hearing for the cross-examination, and be able to just basically educate them. It's like, this is your right. You have a right to tell them what was your case. And if you don't remember, just say you don't remember, and it's okay not to remember. But sometimes I think what happens is an immigration judge, especially in that formal setting, they can intimidate the client, the respondent, to basically come up with answers that may not be accurate. Right, and then it gets to a point where, of course, they've basically written, the client has testified and written a denial for the judge out of fear, out of the fact that they've been traumatized. So preparation of the client for their testimony is incredibly important.
Right. Another problem that we have in Atlanta is the judges trying to push attorneys through testimony. They do it to me every single time. I've seen them do it to other attorneys, where they're trying to rush your testimony, remind you that there's only an hour left in your slot, make faces when you're asking questions, or when they are objecting to your asking questions, they're making faces. And you need to make sure that you put that on the record. You need to make sure that you interrupt the record and have it be shown that not only is the judge concerned about the fact that we only have 1 hour left when I'm in the middle of my direct, but on top of that, they're making faces that are making me uncomfortable or that are making my client uncomfortable. Sometimes I'll ask, Your Honor, are you feeling well? Because you just made a terrible-looking face at me. And they really hate it when you do that, but eventually what happens is that they stop making those faces. Now, they might have the same feelings inside, but at least you're protecting your client from the visuals. And so your client doesn't have to look at a judge that's looking up in the ceiling and it's just bobbling or is breathing deeply or is making, you know, horrible faces. Make sure that you stop the non-verbal signals that the judges are showing your client, because your clients are picking up on those. They're not picking up on the language because they're not even hearing the judge's words, since there's usually a translation. They're really looking at the judge's body language. In Atlanta, they use body language to intimidate, and you have to stop that.
Catalina, how do you stop that, those nonverbal cues? You just go on the record and say, the judge, I just want to note that the judge scowled or the judge smirked.
Exactly. And sometimes, I mean, obviously I will not do it for petty things, but the judges here are usually very clear about their dislike. So I will interrupt and I will have the record reflected, or I will ask the judge if he's feeling ill. If I'm particularly upset with him, I'll make some sort of a comment and I'll explain that the way that they're looking at it makes me think like they're having a heart attack. They'll look at me, they'll pierce their eyes at me. But, you know, eventually what happens is that halfway through the hearing, they will stop doing that. And that's really, really important because, you know, client intimidation is just sort of like a soft tissue abuse, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, just interrupt the record. Just say, and do it politely. You don't have to be aggressive. You don't have to be rude. You don't have to go out of your comfort zone. You can be very polite the way that you do this. You can explain the reason that you're upset about the way that they're looking at you or your client. And you can say, the court is clearly intimidating me. I'm feeling hostility towards me. I'd like to know why on the record. And hopefully that that makes it.
All right. So one thing I wanted to sort of back up and discuss a little bit is you know, we've discussed several things and how to frame them for appeal, and both of our other panelists have noted that, you know, credibility and facts, et cetera, are harder on appeal. And I did just want to briefly review for folks who don't do as many appeals that the reason for that is that issues of law, judgment, discretion, and most issues are reviewed de novo by the board, but that issues of fact, including determinations of credibility, are reviewed only for clear error. And so there are some appellate tactics to both trial and appellate tactics to avoid having to come up against clear error review. In terms of trial, it is what Carolina and Andres were talking about, especially with credibility, about getting out in front of any discrepancies before they occur, or explaining any discrepancies that already are present in the record. For appeals, you want to look at your circuit case law. The board is famously unwilling to describe what clear error means in the context of credibility, but there's at least one or two cases in every circuit where, since the Real ID Act, the circuit court has been willing to reverse an adverse credibility finding, and usually this involves a tactic on appeal of that the immigration judge has to give specific and cogent reasons for an adverse credibility finding, and if you are just really able to, don't go beyond the reasons given by the immigration judge. If the immigration judge gives one reason, attack that one reason. If the immigration judge gives three reasons, attack those three reasons. You have to look at the IJ's opinion. And if those reasons are speculative or otherwise impermissible, that's how to attack an adverse credibility determination on appeal. One thing I will note, and this is an argument that unfortunately we're having to make somewhat often, is this idea about impeachment by omission. This is a pattern we've seen in an argument that we're often making on appeal, that because the I-589 or because the credible fear interview notes didn't contain a piece of information that was elicited on direct examination during the merits hearing, some immigration judges are using that as a basis for making an adverse credibility determination. And we here at the BIA Pro Bono Project do believe that that is an impermissible basis for an adverse credibility determination, especially where it comes from the credible fear notes, right? So at trial, you still want to get out ahead of it. You still want to provide an affirmative explanation for why that information was not in the notes or in the application for relief. But do appeal those if especially if the sole basis for the immigration judge finding that your client was not credible was an omission from the credible fear notes. Appeal that determination. Because credible fear notes, if you look at the lesson plan for how asylum officers are taught to do credible fear interviews, in addition to notations usually on the form, credible fear notes do not purport to be complete. Both the interview itself can be completed without obtaining a client's full claim, and then the notes themselves are not transcripts of the interview. So an omission from those notes should, as a matter of law, not be able to be held against a client.
Well, as a matter of just advice, I try and tell my clients that, you know, when they're testifying, to be able to, if something comes up that wasn't in the declaration, that to explain is, well, I didn't have, you know, the ability to write a book about what happened in Honduras, right? I only had 1 hour to write the declaration, right? Or however much time you took to prepare that test, that declaration. Because what happens here in Charlotte is they'll compare. Let's assume that CFA is not part of the record, or the, it is part of the record, but it's assumed that it wasn't as detailed as it could be. Then the next way they can find a discrepancy is between the declaration, which is asked by two of the three judges here in Charlotte, and the testimony. And to be able to explain that the declaration is not completely comprehensive of everything that happened, and to prepare the client for that possible discrepancy or that possible omission where something comes up which wasn't in the declaration, and to be able to say, it's like, well, I only had 2 hours writing my declaration with my attorney, and it wasn't something that we got to. You know, that way it's on the record, and you protect yourself on appeal rather than the judge saying, well, if this was really an important part of your asylum claim, you should have put it in your declaration, and now you're saying it in your testimony. You omitted that in your declaration, therefore I'm going to find adverse credibility finding.
I have I practice in every case that I have. My practice is to redo their statement whenever possible, and I do an incredibly long statement that has everything possible under the sun. And I begin preparing the statement when they first retain me, and then I finish doing the statement when I am done preparing their testimony. And that could be 2 or 3 or 4 meetings. I've actually, in some of my asylum cases, I've actually had to meet with clients 5 and 6 times, just so that they're prepared to testify. But I normally will submit an amended declaration. And this is the damn if you will, damn if you don't, because when I do that, oftentimes immigration judges dismiss it because, oh, sure, now you have a complete declaration because you have an attorney, Ms. Antonini, you know, help you do this. And I'll object to that characterization of the work, explaining to the judges that if we didn't do this, then they would find fault in the statement that were submitted previously that were prepared either pro se or by another attorney. If it is possible, re-prepare the statement, do an amended statement, and make sure that you put everything under the sun that you can imagine, and make sure that you do that at the end of your preparation, because at that point you should have all the details of the case.
Thanks, Carolina. One last thing, we're about ready to wrap up here, but I did want to throw to the panel, in addition to appealing to benefit the particular client in the particular matter, we have race concerns that we are in these courtrooms often. What strategies have you employed to approach the Assistant Chief Immigration Judges and the Office of the Chief Immigration Judge, because these immigration judges, they have bosses too. And so I wanted to throw that to the panel about strategies, if you feel like you need to complain to the ACIJ.
Yeah, absolutely. Use your ACIJ as a way to start holding judges accountable. I know that the one for Charlotte, she has started working, started looking into certain types of behavior by the judges. I would recommend meeting with other colleagues who have similar experiences with the judge with respect to a certain issue, whether it's how they treat pro se respondents, whether it's they threaten filing complaint against you. Whatever it is, you want to make sure that you have the A number. If it's on the record, you can tell the ACIJ what it was, and they can look into it because they can look on the record. Or you can tell them, it's like, this was off the record. He took, you know, and then the ACIJ will know it was off the record because they see the breaks in the record. The more you do it with other colleagues, the more likely an ACIJ is going to talk to the judge and basically let them know that something is inappropriate or something, that there's a perception that they are biased or hostile.
There are 2 other things that you could do. You certainly can use the liaison meetings to bring up issues, maybe not specific to a case, maybe yes. But if you, in the liaison meetings that we have with EOIR, those are good places to bring in sort of the broad brushstroke of problems. But another thing that I use is that I will speak to the immigration judge directly. I will ask the immigration judge to meet me or approach the bench. And if it's about a specific case, I will ask somebody from the government to be there. If it's just in general, their demeanor towards me when I present these cases, I will go and speak to them and explain to them how offended I am. And I usually walk out of there with that, oh, Ms. Antonini, we didn't mean to offend you. You know, we really appreciate you and so forth. I don't know that it's changed things for me significantly. I do well with asylum claims in asylum. But then again, I don't know whether speaking to an immigration judge directly is something that a lot of our members would be willing to do. But it does humanize the issue to them, particularly when all of our immigration judges are completely under the belief that there is no problem in Atlanta and that the numbers are accurate, an accurate reflection of the quality of cases that they get and not the quality of decisions that they make.
Right. I do know that ACIJ for Charlotte has the only way she can do something is if you give her examples. And there, if she doesn't get examples of what's been done, it's hard for her to look into it. So, I mean, that's what you keep in mind with the ACIJ. That's all I have.
And I think that's all we're going to have for today. Thank you, Carolina and Andres.
Thank you, Brian.
And that's the end of our podcast for today. Thank you for listening.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.